Hi, Kate O'Toole here. Welcome to the guest room at ABC Local Online. I hope you enjoy this download. And don't forget, you can hear the guest room live each weekday from 11 a.m. on 105.7 ABC Darwin and 783 ABC Alice Springs.
We used to sit around the campfire.
And I was given a job as an assistant in the underpants section.
Wasn't so much a surprise when it happened, but it was most certainly a shock. I don't look back at it as a particularly bad part of my life.
I just felt there was something there.
The guest room.
This was the identity that we had seen on screen.
At that particular point of that era, heroin was a major epidemic within the music industry.
With Kate O'Toole on ABC Local Radio across the territory.
Brings tears to my eyes.
Hello and welcome to the guest room. A great territory story for you today, and it comes from the centre. If you live in Alice Springs, you might have been lucky enough to eat food cooked by Raylene Brown. She's the owner and co-founder of Kunga's Can Cook, a catering company that specialises in native foods collected straight from country. It's a passion that Raylene has had all her life, and she turned it into a business about 11 years ago. During her nomadic childhood, Raylene lived all over the territory, from Wave Hill to Catherine to Tennant Creek to Adelaide River. She even sheltered through Cyclone Tracy in the family bus, if you could imagine that. I can't wait to meet Raylene and hear more of her stories. After this, she's chosen Rod Stewart with Hot Legs. Rod Stewart, Hot Legs on the guest room right across the territory. That song chosen for you by Raylene Brown, the co-founder and owner of Kunga's Can Cook. Raylene, welcome to the guest room.
Oh, thank you.
Now, where did that song take you? Just listening back to that. Did you dance to that somewhere in particular?
I was bopping along here in the studio. It took me back to, I suppose, when I was just starting to venture out and about 18, I suppose, and heading off to the discos. And I still love listening to 70s music now when I'm relaxing doing my gardening. But my children can vouch for that. They hear lots of 70s happening in my home, and I love the era. And he was one of my favourites back then.
Which nightclubs would you go to?
Oh, just all the local hangouts in Alice Springs. Like, I suppose the Telford was still up then, the Telford Alice. And then there used to be Sylvester's Disco at the Riverside, and I think the Gap was just opening then, so we had a few places to go to us in, you know, when I was about 18, so we were quite lucky. And I remember all the Spangle and the Sparkle and the leopard skin pants and
anything to make the most of your hot legs, right?
Oh yeah, no, I'm only a shorty. I wish I had hot legs, long legs. But anyway, it takes me back, and I still love listening to that music now.
Oh, fantastic. Now, a lot of people listening would know you as an Alice Springs local, but you really did grow up all over the territory, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Your family has such an interesting history. Can you tell me a little bit about your nana? She was from Daly River, was she?
Yeah, she was from the Daly, and she was born near the Moyle River. And I suppose Daly was a campsite, and then she was, when she was a teenager, she was kind of taken away from the community, and she had to go and work as a domestic in the Adelaide River pub back then. So I suppose that would have been in the 1930s back then. And
when you say she was taken, was she forcibly taken?
I think she was, yeah, she was pretty much forcibly taken. My mum said there was a few young girls and men working in the local town there. So she was a domestic there. I think she was just doing cleaning for the owner of the pub there. So, yeah.
And your mum was actually born at the Adelaide River pub.
Yeah, she was born there. And I never never, and that's the thing too, that I never really knew my grandfather, my real grandfather. I knew his name was Jack White, and whenever I mention a Jack White in Darwin, there's three Jack Whites. I said there was an Aboriginal Jack White, and then a half-caste Jack White, and then there was a white Jack White. So I'm not really sure, and we don't really know the history, but I never met him, and my mum and my nana never saw him again after that either. So when they got taken away from there, they were put on a truck and sent away to Alice Springs. And I think my nana was put into one of the, don't know whether it was a bungalow here, or I'm not really, really sure about the history of it. But
so you, when you're talking about them being put on a truck, was that the evacuation when World War II broke out?
Yeah, that's right, because my mum's birth certificate was in the Darwin Post Office when the Darwin Post Office got blown up, so she kind of found it a bit difficult getting information about herself when she was a small child and when she got married. So I don't think she even knows the right year that she was born, because, you know, we can't find any records on her anywhere. And about my nana either, I've tried searching, and a lot of the old people have passed away that could have told us more information. So
did you hear stories from that time? Did you hear stories about how your nana and your mum remembered that evacuation?
No, and I never met my nana either, because my nana passed away when she was 30 years old. She had she met and married a fellow called Jack Neal, and I call him my grandfather because he grew my mum up, and that's all my mum ever knew, and she never really found out about that until she was the day she got married, that her grandfather Jack came up to her and said, "I'm not your real dad." And she nearly fainted on the day that she married, because she had no idea. So things
talk about choosing your timing.
I know. It was a bit of a, she said it was a big shock for me, and she sort of blocked it out of her mind because she didn't want to think about it. And because no one had told her anything, it was hard for her to deal with. So even now, Mum sort of doesn't talk about it much at all, and doesn't have much memory, you know, kind of sort of blanks it out a bit. But I've found bits and pieces out, and I've gone back to my nana's country and spoken to people there, and they said that they were so sad that they never got to see her again. So my nana and my mum, yeah. So it's a bit of it's a sad start. But
must have been hard on your mum losing her mother early.
Yeah, it was. She was the oldest, so and Grandpa Jack used to always be away, because he used to build windmills on stations around Central Australia, so he was away a lot. And my nana was quite ill with rheumatics, and her being the oldest child, she had a lot of responsibility, like taking care of her brothers and sisters. So she's I take my hat off to her. I have so much respect for my mum. I love my mum so much, and I know she had a really hard life, and but she never sort of talked about it much, but as I've gotten older, I've realised how hard it was for her.
When did she meet your dad?
I think she met my dad in 1940. I'm born. I think it was 1963, and it was a whirlwind romance. I think she was a bit afraid of, you know, being the last person married out of all of her girlfriends, and that she'd been so busy, you know, looking after brothers and sisters, that this handsome fellow from Melbourne turned up in Alice and swept her off her feet, and they were married, I think, within about 2 weeks or something like that. But they were married at the Catholic Church here in town, and then they
talk about a whirlwind romance.
I know.
So what was your dad, Ray? What was he like?
He was a crazy man. No, he was a hard bloke. He was very strict. And he's from Victoria, and I knew he was born in Warburton in Victoria. He had a pretty hard upbringing as well. And I only started to find this all out when I was in my late 30s about his past as well. And then I started to understand that the person that he was, his mother passed away also when he was about 4 years old. And he only thought that he had two brothers, one sister in his life, But he found out in his 60s that he actually had 8 extra siblings. So he grew up in and out of reform homes in Victoria, in and out of the, you know, the Salvation Army looked after him. And he had lots of, his dad was had I think it was some sort of really bad disease, and they couldn't really take care of him. And I know he had a hard life, because I know that he used to live in the Melbourne markets. He'd sleep in the potato bags in the markets when everybody went home. And he used to steal newspapers from when the newspapers got dropped on the streets to make money to eat and live. So, yeah, he had a hard life. And I think he ended up working on around stations and that. And he ended up in Broken Hill, and then he ended up on the South Road heading north to Alice Springs. And then, that's where he met my mum.
He went to jail not long after you were born.
Yeah.
What was that
in
for?
In the old jail in Darwin. I think he got up to a bit of mischief here in town, and don't know whether it was a cause of necessity back then that he got in trouble for, you know, thieving something. And anyway, I know that I think it was either just after I was born or just on my sister, because we were born really close together, me and my sister Jenny. I was 64 and she was 63. So, and I remember he went up into jail for a few years in Darwin. So my mum had to go up there, and I don't think I saw him again until I was about 2.5 or 3 years old. So I think then after that he kind of realised he had a wife and children, and he had to, you know, start behaving himself. So it was a hard start for my mum too. I think she was so shocked, because she was a Catholic girl, and she was very innocent, and I think it was a bit of an abrupt, you know.
It's not sort of what you'd expect from the start of your marriage, and also after getting married, so having that whirlwind romance,
and then
getting
it.
Married after a couple of weeks and then going, okay. Who am I married exactly?
Yeah, I know. She was a very kind-hearted lady and very, you know, very quiet. And she is still very quiet, still really a quiet lady. I think I've got this gift of the gab, yap, yap thing from my dad.
Not from your ma.
No, mum's very quiet and demure, and she's she just does things in the background, yep.
You're listening to The Guest Room right across the territory. Raylene Brown is with you today. She's the co-founder and the owner of Kunga's Can Cook, a catering company that's based in Alice Springs, which specialises in bush foods. So when you moved then, when your mum moved up to Darwin, was that the start of this nomadic childhood for you?
Yeah, I think we ended up, after Dad came out of the jail up there, I think Dad thought, well, we better go bush. And so I think that's when we started heading south, and we ended up on Wave Hill, and my dad was fencing. And my mum, I think not long after that, my mum, you know, they were there for about a year, and I think my mum was having another baby, but she used to drive the tractor along. She never had a licence, but she used to drive the tractor along with all the pegs on the back, and we'd move along the fence line. And some old ladies there, old Indigenous ladies there, used to look after me, and we used to follow along and walk miles and miles fencing. And it was a hard life too, like living in camp style, just living out in the open up there. And I remember Mum saying it was pretty hard, but the ladies up there were just so lovely. And Mum said I started speaking lingo up there, because I'd hardly ever be with Mum and Dad. I'd always be with all the ladies around there chatting and sitting around the campfire cooking. So, yeah, they'd come back and say, oh, Raylene's learning to talk, but she's not learning English. She's talking Gurindj. So, no.
Were there a lot of people? Did it feel, was it a...
Yeah, it was a great place, you know, like back then. It was a lot of community mob around. They used to be all working and during the dry season and that, and then... Mum said round about Christmas time everybody used to just walk off and go bush again. And but we just sort of, my mum and dad just sort of worked along. And I think after that they ended up in Dunmara. Mum got a job working there as a cook and a housemaid, and Dad was just doing some jobs around there for a while.
And so what would cause the moves? Would it be when there wasn't work on?
Yeah, or? When the work wasn't on. So... And then I know that because my mum was having another baby, so I knew that not after that we ended up in Melbourne. I don't know how that happened. But
that's a move.
Because I know my brother
Harold.
Much
fencing going on in Melbourne at that
stage. No, I think it was just that my dad had been away and that he wanted to go back and see his sister, because she got adopted out to somebody else and he got adopted out. So, but they still kind of kept in contact. But I think Dad wanted to go back and see her. So Mum had my brother Harold in Melbourne. And I remember mum saying she was so, so nervous about going and meeting these white fellas in Melbourne, you know, because she said, oh, they're not going to like me. They're not going to like me. I'm an Aboriginal. And my dad said, I don't care. I'm taking you back. You got to meet my family. And mum was so embarrassed and she was so ashamed, she said. And she was standing up there and this, they'd knocked on this door. And because my auntie was living in Flemington at the time. And she said, this lady come bouncing out the door with these cat weasel glasses on and just grabbed my mum and hugged her. And she was a lovely lady, my Auntie Margaret. Yeah, she welcomed my mum with open arms. So, yeah, she was so glad that she said, I'm glad that lady liked me. She's my future sister-in-law, so, yeah.
I can imagine the relief.
Yeah.
But so then you're back up at Humpty Doo by the time Cyclone Tracy happened.
Yeah, we ended up back in Humpty Doo. And we were living in Adelaide River before then. We went back to, I think that we, after that, we went back to Alice, and the work ran out in the 1970s in Alice Springs. And so my dad started heading north looking for work, and there wasn't really a lot around. So we ended up in Adelaide River again, and we sort of couldn't find anywhere to stay. So there was some makeshift sheds or and stuff like them. There's some old cement blocks left along the side of the river from the army days. So my dad started building a little kind of a hut there for us to live in. There was a couple of other families there too, living. I remember one of the mob was Wesley's, and another family who were there were kind of travelling with us with the Roscoes and stuff as well. So there wasn't any work, but then all of a sudden there was a contract there to build the new road, the bitumised road to between Adelaide River and Darwin. So Dad got a job on the water truck, and Mum got a job cooking in the camp for all the fellas. So yeah, we were in work again.
Yay!
But we lived after that. We moved from the side of the river, and I went to Adelaide River School for a little while. But I absolutely loved it. I remember
living on the river.
It was the best, because every day. I mean, we never had any shoes. We used to walk no shoes. We didn't have to wear shoes to school back then. And we'd walk home along the river. This is before all the crocs moved in, of course. And I remember getting mussels every afternoon, and we had a little billy can halfway home and a little packet of matches. And we'd make a little fire, get the fresh mussels, cook them up, have a feed, then keep walking home. But it was just wonderful. We swam and fished, and I loved it. But I don't know about my mum.
It sounds amazing for you. I'm not sure what it would have been like for mum.
Yeah, we lived on fish, kangaroo, mussels, anything. It was just a lot of fish, yeah, because abundance of fish there, freshwater fish.
So
really lovely.
Why did you move from there to Humpty Doo?
Well, after the road job was finished, we moved up to Humpty Doo then, because Dad got a job up there driving trucks around Darwin with Darwin truck owners. And and then I went to Berrimah Primary School, so we sort of had how many kids in? I think there was 1, 2, 3, Chongi, Colin, and Sam. So there was 5. And at Humpty Doo, and before the cyclone hit, Mum was pregnant, and there was baby number 6 coming. So all this travelling and, yeah, lots of children. And
so what do you remember about Cyclone Tracy?
Oh, I remember we were in Darwin at the start of it, and we'd been at a Christmas party. Dad had been at Darwin Truck Owners, and we'd all been sitting there. And we were just kids running around the shed hiding, and the wind started blowing. And my mum was saying, oh, Ray, I think we better go home, you know, there's a big storm coming. Oh, no, don't worry, it's a party, let's stay. And anyway, by the time we eventually started heading home, trees was falling across the road, and we were in this old combi van. And it was sort of getting blown all over the place, and we were, oh, yeah, well, us kids having a great time, you know, getting chucked around the car, and Mum was panicking. And we got home all right, and we locked ourselves up in the bus, and, the storm started really bad then. It was just crazy. The wind was just, it was howling, and the rain was just pouring down. It was bucketing down. I'd, you know, been through the wet seasons, but never seen it so... just, it was just amazing.
So you were, that drive home was in the combi, but then you were actually living in
a bus.
How did the bus handle it?
The bus was rocking and rolling. It was going from, as the winds were picking up, it was just going from side to side. So you could imagine a big Leyland bus, a big heavy old bus, how strong that wind was, that it was actually tipping the bus from one side to the other.
Were you worried it'd fly away?
I was worried we were going to just go boom, flat over, and we had nothing to hold on to because there weren't any seats in the bus because that was our house. It was like there were beds in there. I mean, not that I was in the bus. My bed was outside. It was already underwater. But the other kids were all, and Mum and Dad were in the bus, and all the furniture was just sliding this way, that way. But yeah, a big ironwood tree fell on us and sort of, you know, pinned us down. And Mum said, "Thank God for that ironwood tree, I tell you." Because when we were had a chance to evacuate, my dad was there, "No, no, no, we'll be fine, we'll be fine." So the neighbours took off to the pub and we stuck it out.
If that ironwood tree hadn't pinned the bus down, though, it could have been, you could have blown over.
Oh, it could
over.
Have been disastrous, I know. And my mum was having a baby and she was just, I just wouldn't have imagined of what would have happened. So, yeah, I'm really grateful for that. But my mum was praying. She was saying, I know she was praying, and I think that tree came down for that. But, yeah, that saved us, basically.
Your family stayed in the aftermath of Tracy as well. What did your parents do in the cleanup?
Well, my dad just went around and he helped to clean up all the debris as much as they could. There was a whole heap of people that stayed behind and then waited till the army came in. And we thought it was great fun because every time, you know, on the weekends, we'd go into the old dump at Larrakia, you know, at the dump there. And Leanya dump. And my uncle was living not far from the dump. And he'd collect all the toys because everything got tipped out, the whole of all the toy stores and everything. So we had a field day. He'd have beautiful little Barbie dolls and nail polish and all kinds of things. So we had a great time.
All this stuff that you never would have been able to get otherwise.
Oh, no, no. We had to share everything. We remember that we got a bike that year for Christmas that we had to share between four of us. So, you know, being able to have all these toys and that readily available, we just thought, oh my goodness, we're in glory land here.
Who cares if Barbie's a bit dirty and maybe missing a limb?
Yeah, she still smelt nice. Her hair still smelt nice. But no, it was great, you know. I mean, my mum probably wanted to be evacuated out and she would have loved to have come home, but...
Yeah, I bet.
The dad just said, no, we're staying. We're going to help to clean up. So I thought that was a great thing my dad did, you know. He was part of that clean up and... helped to, you know, a lot of people didn't want to come back after the cyclone, but, and we never did either, but I know my dad went back there and lived for a while, yeah.
The next song that you've chosen for us, Raylene, is a song that has some memories of your dad as well. This is a Glen Campbell song. Can you tell us what this reminds you of?
Oh, yeah, my dad was a crazy Glen Campbell fan and, you know, we'd have a few beers, the Glen Campbell, the old stereo, the old record player would come out and you'd hear Glen Campbell blasting. And we used to detest it, but I've grown to love Glen Campbell and it brings back a lot of memories for me when I was a kid growing up and being nomadic along the Stuart Highway. Yep, many a time I've heard this song.
I am a lineman for the county and I drive the main road, searching in the sun for another overload.
Right across the territory, you're listening to The Guest Room. Kate O'Toole with you, joined today by Raylene Brown, the co-founder and owner of Kungas Can Cook, a catering company. Raylene, though, before we get to the evolution of that, you left school when you were 14. I can imagine that nomadic lifestyle we were talking about wouldn't have helped with the schooling. But what did you do when you left?
Well, at the time there was the CES was in town back then and there was a little traineeship going on. And so I signed up and it was all about etiquette, actually. It was a retail sales course, but we had to learn how to dress, how to put makeup on, how to walk with a book on our head. I don't know how that was helping me being a checkout chick, but anyway.
this is for all of this, how to put on makeup to be checkout chick. Is that
It was, I don't know, maybe it came in handy a bit later on. Anyway, we got to use lots of nice, how to put makeup on, you know, like it was blue back then, remember? Blue eyeshadow. My God, it was just stark and looked bad on me. But, I went through the course and I got a job in Todd Street in Woolies back then. And didn't do too well, really, because I could never balance my till at the end of the night. No one really explained to me anything, you know, how to do it properly. I know now it was so easy, but I just used to be so embarrassed that I would, and I'd be the last one there every night trying to balance my till, and I'd be thinking, they probably think that I've taken the money or something, you know. But I was never good at maths, but I left when I was 14 at school, and I know I always failed in maths. But
interesting that they taught you how to put on makeup for the job, but didn't actually teach you how to balance your till.
I know. That was a bit crazy, I thought. It would have come in handy, yeah.
You got a job at the Central Land Council, though, when you were 18 that really opened your eyes. What was it like there?
Well, yeah, I was in the old Hartley Street office, and back when Land Council was only probably in a couple of spaces around town, and I got a job as a receptionist there. And right at the time, and I'd just only probably been there for about a week, and a major event happened in the desert, you know, in our desert. The Pindaby mob walked in, and it was just absolute chaos. World media were trying to contact this little office in the middle of, you know, in Alice Springs, and I was flicking people through, cutting people off. There was telexes going mad behind me, and that event, and I was just, you know, so glad that I was there when it happened, and it sort of started opening my eyes to Indigenous issues and the issues around remote Indigenous people and their plights and things. So,
can you describe why that event was so significant?
Well, because for me it was like, oh my, this is the last mob now, you know, left living traditional life in the desert, you know, and how things were in the communities as I saw it when I was a kid, you know. It was the last mob now, and this is the whole world for Indigenous people is gonna change from now on. And it started making me realise what issues were out there for Indigenous people, you know, around land, around health, around all these things, you know.
Did it make you think differently about being an Aboriginal person?
It did. It really did. And the thing is that when I was a kid growing up, I never thought about racism. I don't think anybody was ever racist to me or to my mum, because she never talked about it. But it sort of started bringing up these things around racism and how people were treated and how people had to live in some cases in third world conditions out in the bush, you know. And it was in the world news, you know, like that these pictures have flashed all over the place, and you know, it really brought home to me. And then I started getting very passionate about Indigenous issues and about land rights, and I was glad that I was a part of that when the Land Rights Act was in place, and being a part of some of those land claims around the Northern Territory, helping to put together documents and information and helping the anthros and lawyers put things together. We'd be pasting together genealogies, big rolls of genealogies for the judges, and it was, you know, for me it was like an eye-opening thing, and I was glad to be a part of that.
And did you feel as though did you consider yourself an activist?
Yeah, I think I was a bit of an activist back then.
Yeah, no, I'm just trying
because
to...
Because marching down, you know, like back then it was...
So you were marching as well, because I was thinking this activism with a whole lot of paper and through the legal system as opposed to marching down the main street, but you were doing that as well.
Yeah, we used to have lots of marches and things, you know, and lots of rallies and stuff. A lot of the organisations worked together back then. When NAIDOC came around, it was a really big time, and it was time to bring, you know, issues to the fore and bring it to the streets and walk down with placards and big banners. And I was so glad that I got to meet so many great, you know, people back then that were fighting the fight, you know. And the funny thing is that then my mum said to me that Charlie Perkins actually was living in my mum's house when he was a young boy. And I didn't know that back then, you know. I didn't know that in Alice Springs when she was a girl growing up, and I thought, oh, that's great, you know. And then I met Charlie Perkins as well. And then I met his daughter later on, because I'd worked with her when I got my, you know, a bit further down the track. But, yeah, it was, for me it was there. My heart started beating. I started getting really involved, and I felt passionate, and I just felt like, you know, I was doing my bit, you know, for Indigenous people. And although I just got caught up in it all, and it was great to be a part of it.
Where did the passion for food come in? Because this passion for Indigenous issues had been awakened, and you said that your mum was a cook, but how did your passion for that area of your life come about?
And I remember when I was younger and my mum was working as a cook, that I would be always the one helping her, you know, prepare the food, peeling the potatoes, chopping things up, even cooking for my brothers and sisters, because if a mum wasn't home, I'd have to cook dinner and get everybody organised. So that was part of my job back then. But, you know, I've always loved cooking. And actually, my dad was a great cook as well. He was a really good cook. You ask a lot of the local mob about his satays. They were just amazing, his satays. He made the most amazing marinades. Everybody wanted his recipes. And I'm lucky enough that he handwrit all of his recipes out for me. And we're going to do a little book up, my daughter and I, and we're going to pass it around the family. But that passion for cooking is on both sides of the family.
And when you were helping your mum out or getting, you know, dinner ready, or when you were young, was that bush food as well?
Yeah, well, when we were living in Adelaide River, we had a fair bit of bush food. Like, we just live off kangaroo and fish and berries and all kinds of things out there, you know, like... It was part of our life when we were living in the bush. But when we got to move into town and Mum sort of said to Dad, that's it, I'm not moving anymore, I'm staying here now, you know, we sort of lost that a bit, you know. We started, okay, the shop's down the road, everything's in a packet and you know, but even though still I was still cooking at home, but we sort of lost that bush tucker stuff, you know, what we used to live on. And I suppose it happened to a lot of Indigenous people too as they moved into town, that a lot of that, you know, they didn't have access to that. But I did know a few families that down the gap that always had that kangaroo pit in their backyard. They'd all still go out shooting and get a kangaroo, so that was still a big part of it. The kangaroos never stopped coming.
You were cooking at big land council meetings sometimes, but your first professional cooking job out bush was for 100 Walpiri women. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, a friend of ours was in a bit of a sticky situation. He was trying to run this big education meeting out bush for supporting the Indigenous teachers out there, and he said, "Gina and Raylene, I really need your help. Could you just take a week off from Land Council and come and help me to cook for all these women?" And we thought, "Oh yeah, no worries. We'll be in that. We'll come and give you a hand." And so he picked us up with our trailer, and we went out to Laramba. We spent 1 week in the women's centre there. We never moved out of there because we had no idea about preparation. We had no idea what we were doing. I mean, we did have a bit of an idea, but just two of us, and we usually had a few extra people, but it was 100 women. So we were pretty busy over that week. And then after we looked at our feet, how fat they were and swollen, we said, oh, maybe this is not the job for us. Maybe not. Anyway.
Just from standing on your feet all that time?
Oh, my feet were like pads on the bottom. I couldn't, because I was sitting in an office most of the time. We'd go out bush and we'd have a break, you know, plenty of people to give you a hand. But it was just the two of us doing the whole thing on our own. So my feet was quite swollen and I was so tired. But they invited us in, all the women, and they'd done some beautiful little paintings and drawings and cards for us and said how much they'd appreciated our lovely meals and that the success of the whole meeting would not have happened without us. And they said that we should start a business. So the inspiration for that came from them Indigenous ladies out there, you know, all those old ladies. And we were in tears. Don't know whether it was tears from being so tired or... But, you know, just that they'd been so grateful for what we've done, and the whole meeting was a great success. So, you know, food is such an important part, isn't it? So,
yeah. And the swollen feet forgotten.
Well and truly.
With that praise.
It was a job well done, and it sort of sparked something in us, me and Gina. We started thinking really hard about what our future was going
to
be.
So you went from cooking for 100 people then to cooking for up to 1,000 people. How did that happen?
Well, somebody had heard that we'd sort of done this bit of cooking out there for 100 people and decided that we should put in a quote to do a job for 1,000 people. So I did.
I can't imagine how big your feet would have been after that.
Oh, my goodness. I think I wanted someone to bury me after that. But anyway, I didn't think that we'd get the job. I put the quote in. never been in negotiations for such a big thing in my life. I was so nervous when I went to meet the producers. It was for the Iparinya Festival. It was pretty scary doing that. It was my first kind of introduction to doing business with, you know, in big corporate kind of thing.
You didn't even have any forks or
no, didn't have a fork. Or? We didn't own a fork. We didn't own a plate. We didn't own a truck. We didn't own anything, a pot even. So I don't know what we were thinking about saying, oh, yeah, we can put a quote in. Never thinking that we'd get it. And anyway, Gina had gone off to she'd been invited to go over and perform at the Olympics in the opening ceremony. And I had to ring her and say, Gina, we got the job. Oh, my goodness, what are we going to do? So I tell you, we were scrambling like crazy. So 1,000 people.
And the business was born.
The business was born. And from from what we'd done after we'd paid everybody and paid for everything, we bought our first set of pots and a trailer and a few bits and pieces that you'd need to start a catering business. We did things completely back to front. But yeah, I think I learnt then that I was a bit of a risk taker. So yeah, jumped in head first, basically into the hot frying pan.
We'll hear a little bit about bush foods because that's something that you're really passionate about. We'll hear more about that in a moment. But let's hear another song that you've chosen for us today. Why did you pick this Gurumul song?
I just love this guy singing. He has the most amazing voice. And for me too, you know, how he's, you know, his blindness, he has gone so far with all this, you know, the barriers that are there for him. But he's such a beautiful singer. He sings from his soul. He sings from his country. And I just have immense respect and for this fellow. And I just really love his voice. And I love this song.
Where I Was Born Blind for Raylene Brown, the co-founder and owner of Kungas Can Cook in Alice Springs. Raylene, a central part of your business is native foods. And one thing that I think is really great is that you get them straight from women out bush. Can you describe that part of your business?
Yeah, well, mainly the lady that do the wild harvesting, all the women out there, mainly around Utopia and in Bladderwich area. I met these ladies when I was working and doing some stuff with Desert Knowledge Australia. We sort of went and did a little trip to Melbourne, and we sort of wanted to follow the bush tomato or follow the bush tucker to where it goes so that the women could understand about, you know, what happens with their bush tucker when it's all harvested and where it goes. So went down to the factories and I struck up a really great relationship because I know there was someone else in town. Peter Yates used to do travel out on country, but he's moved away now. So for the last few years, the women still continuously harvest, but, you know, they wanted someone else to bring it into. So I said, look, I'll start buying it and help you to sort of distribute it out. So, yeah, I'm really great that I have this great relationship with these ladies and they... I never know when they're coming. I just get a phone call and it's just, oh, we've got kajira or bush tomato or we've got wattle seed, you know. So it's not sort of a thing where, you know, it's all on a business deal. It's just mainly you wait for the phone call, it happens and it all just ends up in town and then I buy it all. But I have a great respect for these women and I just really support the wild harvest because... I think, you know, it's such a great thing that this is still happening, you know, for thousands of years on country and it's being passed down, you know, generation to generation. It helps with also, you know, keeping the young people involved in country and learning the stories about country and learning the dances and everything as well. So with all my bush foods that I use in my kitchen, I'll only use the wild harvest. I won't buy anything that's come from farms and things because I really want to support this local product and support these women.
What sort of stories do the women have with the food that they harvest?
Well, it's like, you know, that's their totem. The women that go out and harvest this food, that story belongs to them. So, you know, if there's a younger girl that's, you know, they're next in line, then that story gets passed along. So that story for that bush tomato or kajira, it belongs to one of those elderly ladies. And as they're walking along through country, they're talking to the ancestors, they're taking the children along, and they're not only just harvesting, they're hunting for other things as well, like the kids might go along and they'll get a goanna, or they might find some witchetty grub, or so it's a really beautiful thing. And that connection of that bush tucker to these ladies and their stories, to me, has such great power. And so I think that when they start to farm this stuff and put it into jars and that it loses that beautiful story, and it loses that connection with the Indigenous people. So I don't want to see that lost, and that's why I will continue to, you know, buy and stuff off the women, and to keep that going, and yeah, to keep those stories going. So, and then when I talk about it to tourists or visitors that come in, I can say, you know, I know exactly where this food comes from, I know the women, and it's all just, it's really, to me, it's ethical, you know.
You're just about to go overseas for the first time in your life. How exciting. Where are you heading?
Oh, my goodness. I can't believe it, really. I'm sort of pinching myself a bit. I'm heading to Europe, and I didn't really plan it. My daughter was going to go overseas with some friends, but it sort of fell through. So she said, oh, Mum, I think you'll have to come with me. And I'm there,
first reserve.
Oh, yeah, that's really nice. Thanks. Anyway, I said, I better start saving, you know. But I'm heading off to Europe, staying and going to London and going to Paris, going to Barcelona, and I'm going to spend, I think, about 2 weeks in Italy. And while I'm there, I'm going to soak up all the food that I can.
Are you going to do a bit of bring some bush food there?
Yeah, I'd love to do that in Italy, actually, because I think our beautiful wattle seed here will go lovely with some of their, like, there's a beautiful wattle seed coffee that's made, and wattle seed ice cream, and it would really, it's actually quite nice in tiramisu. So it's a beautiful flavour, our wattle seeds here. And I just think it blends really nice with the Italian style of cooking. So it goes with ice creams and cream and biscuits and all that sort of stuff.
Oh,
so
you're making my mouth water. That sounds delicious.
I'm so proud of our Centralian bush tucker. So yeah, and I hope to. This is my life now, and I just have such a passion, and like to share the story about bush tucker with as many people as I can. So
thank you for sharing that story with us today, and many more as well over the last hour. I really appreciate that.
Thank you for inviting me on. I feel very privileged to be invited to the guest room.
Hopefully we'll see a Kungas Can Cook restaurant or cafe down the track, perhaps.
Yeah, well, I think so. I think that's the way I should go, maybe. I'm busy already, though.
Take a risk, Raylene. Take a risk. Raylene Brown has been joining you over the last hour. She's the co-founder and owner of Kungas Can Cook, a catering company based in Alice Springs, which uses bush food.
This has been the Northern Territory Guest Room. Listen live each weekday from 11 a.m. Territory time, or go to abc.net.au/Darwin or /Alice Springs to hear more.
If you've enjoyed The Guest Room, you might like to check out Tales from the Tinny as well, also available on podcast at abc.net.au/tinny.